Welcome to Counterculture, the podcast. To keep updated on the podcast, follow me on Twitter at Counterculture with no E's. CounterCulture. Today we're going to be talking to Joseph Ristenmayo. Joe helps me out on the site by going through all the poetry that gets submitted to the site and choosing poems that we feature. Joe is a published poet who travels around doing readings of his poetry, and he's been involved with solar power for many years. So we talked about those things as well as movements from the 1960s up to the Occupy movements of today. We had a really interesting conversation. I hope you enjoy the show. To help us get started, The Smalls.
Joseph Mayo Riston, live in Phoenix, Arizona.
And you run your own solar company, is that right?
Well, at the present time, I own a small solar company. Prior to that, I was the director in sales of marketing with a company out of California here in Phoenix. I've been doing solar off and on since late 1980s, I guess. My partner then, one of my better friends who's passed now, and I had a contract with Energy Co-op when the utility company, PG&E in San Francisco, was caught overbilling their customers and were required by the state of California to give those people who want to take advantage of it $1,000 interest free to be billed over a period of time on their utility bill for home improvements such as insulation, weather stripping, etc. And from there, that's how I got into the solar. Of course, at that time, it was either passive or active. You didn't have the glycol, propylene, or the drain back systems that you have now today.
So you do the installs and stuff yourself, and as well as like handle the business side of it?
Well, I actually handle marketing and the sales side of it. I'm too old to get up on the roofs anymore. That's been on the roofs before, though.
So it's mostly not. Do you guys do commercial installations and stuff, or?
I don't. I have people that I work with that I'm friends with who do. So when I run into that application, I just turn it over to them. With solar, there's your thermal, which is like your domestic hot water, or your pool systems. Thermal for a domestic hot water system runs between, $6,000, $8,500, depending on the application. And it's about, in Arizona, about 80% efficient. So when you take the rebates that are presently available, which are not the same as they were when I moved here to do the solar, they're still better than what PV is in relationship. And then you take the tax credit that you get from the federal government here in the United States of 30% and $1,000 that the state of Arizona has. It's not a real out-of-pocket expense, good improvement on the home. And as I say, it's 80% efficient. When you go to PV, you're talking about a much larger cost involved.
PV, that's for power?
That's your photovoltaic systems where you have the sun hitting cells lined inside the panels that is actually and then you have an inverter that converts it from DC to AC. You have a smart meter, and then it actually calculates how many kilowatts your system's producing compared to what you're using. Mm-hmm. And then it offsets your electric bill accordingly. Now, when I first came here, that rebate was $3 a kilowatt. Now it's like somewhere in the vicinity of, I think, around, based on when you apply for it and get your reservation, or down to like 65, 85 cents. So most of the companies that are now and selling that product are doing it as a lease. I don't participate in leases. I'm really excited about some of the new products.
People are leasing out their rooftops and stuff, you mean?
Exactly. What happens is with a lease is you actually lease the equipment as well as the panels. The system is installed, and you see a certain portion of what kilowatts it produces towards your bill. The company that installs it takes the tax credits, the rebate, and for people who are retired and don't have the ability to use the tax credit, it's probably an okay alternative to purchasing. The problem is there's no financing in this industry to speak of. I mean, there's some financing where you can get a year of zero interest if you qualify, and at this time in our economy, few people do, mm-hmm. So that you can get the money from the utility company that you have coming and hopefully apply all the tax credits in that first year to get those as well. The problem there is, though, is when you finance it that way, your payment to pay off the loan is more expensive than the dollar amount that you're saving from the system. So consequently, you have a break-even point where you actually start seeing the savings of 6 to 8.5 years. Now, you have the improvement on the home, and you're being environmentally friendly, and there's a lot of good things to it. However, most people today, especially in the economy that we are in, are making decisions based on dollars and cents. So the only way really to install solar and have it cost effective is to do a 203K financing with the purchase of a new home. It's a complicated loan where it takes two appraisals, and a lot of the real estate agents get freaked out over it. A lot of the people there in the mortgage industry don't understand the paperwork with it. However, with that loan, a person can finance the system. So like if you have a $40,000 system you're installing in your home, and let's say that system is going to save you, let's say it'd be so that'd be an 8-kilowatt system. You'd be looking at somewhere, you know, in the savings of maybe $300-$350 a month on average on your utility bill. When you finance it over 30 years with your mortgage through a 203K, it only increases the mortgage payment maybe by $65-$80, depending on the, you know, the loan that you have and the interest rate. Mm-hmm. And there, at that point, you're seeing cash flow positive from your investment to your savings immediately, and you get the rebate and the tax credits as well.
So for people building new homes, it's a little, it can be a better deal?
If people are aware and understand, if they want solar, first they have to understand the dynamics of it and be sure they buy a home with the right orientation and the right square footage and a few other things that go with that. But if they refinance, if when they purchase a home, they purchase the installation of the solar and wrap those two purchases together under a 203K loan, that is by far and maybe the only way to actually see it to be cost effective. Because see, even with the lease, you have to put a huge amount of money up front. You still have with the lease 4 to 5 years of having the system operating on your home before you actually see a difference between what you spend out of pocket and what you see in savings. And that's based on today's cost per kilowatt. I mean, that break even point could become less depending on what the cost of kilowatt does. Now,
how come, the rebate or whatever started at $3, now it's 85 cents or whatever? How come it's gone down so much?
Now, that's in Phoenix area with APS and SRP. There are different utility companies like in Tucson that haven't changed them as drastically. But basically, it's set by the commissioners. You have the utility companies promoting it, but at the same time, it's a lot of cash flow that's being taken out of their funds. So how do I put this to make it sound like I'm not like upset about anything? Because I'm never upset about anything that's going on with the industry, but it's not like it's as easy as it seems like it should be. And there was so much money set aside, and unfortunately a lot of that money was used by individuals who put large systems, took total advantage of what was available there. And when the money got used up and they started to see that they were spending a lot out of pocket, more so than they maybe expected to, and that the money that was set aside for this program was being absorbed quicker than that, they started changing the dollar amount of the rebate. So it didn't just go from $3 to $65. It went from $3 to $2.50, then $2. But it all happened within a year and a half. Actually, a little less time than that, but a year and a half approximately. Now, see, when you go back to thermal, one panel, 4x10, whether it's a drain back, a glycol propylene system, or even a passive system, the cost is not nearly as substantial. Again, it's 80% efficient. You don't have the same type of savings, but you see a quicker point where you break even just because of the efficiency factor. And really, one panel that's 4x10 that's domestic hot water heating the water that you use in your home, which also changes the way you can use hot water. I mean, you can use your hot water differently than a lot of people do now, because it's being heated by the sun, using the dishwasher, maybe warm water in your, or hot water, even in your washing machine, or taking an extra shower here or there, isn't going to affect your bill. But one of those panels are about 2,884 kilowatts. Each panel that you see on the roofs where they have multiple panels, which is the PV systems where you're generating electricity from the sun directly, yeah. Those are about 235 kilowatts each. So it's 10 of those panels, which are 9 by 3, so it's 27 times 10. You're talking about, you know, 270 plus square feet, because there's framing and other things that are involved in, and you know, actually installing it on a roof, to a 4 by 10, 40-foot panel that produces pretty much the same number of kilowatts a year. Okay, so thermal, I guess the best way to explain it is thermal's kind of gone. What was being installed in the late 80s, I mean, looks like one of Gaudi's moon rocks, you know, on a building in Barcelona. It looks out of place, doesn't look like it should even be there. A lot of them don't work any longer because they've been there so long. But it's gone full circle, and there's probably not a whole lot, as far as technology goes, that's going to make it so that thermal is going to get any maybe more efficient than it is at the present time. Where with the PV, where that's why I was trying to explain it, it was kind of, to me, a shame that so much money went one way versus another. I would rather seen a lot more homes get the domestic hot water, though it's not as glamorous looking and, quote, as cool. It would have been a lot more efficient across the board as far as saving the kilowatts and having more homes being able to take advantage of that money that was set aside. Hence, you can install, you know, 8 domestic hot water systems for the same amount of money that the utility companies was giving up for maybe one PV installation, based on that being the close to what the average PV installation is on a rooftop of 700 square feet.
If you do enough PV on your, where you're actually producing more power than you're using, what do the electricity companies do? Do they just build you up a credit, can you get paid for that, or what?
That's a really good question. There's very few incidences where that is going to happen. Here in Arizona, you have a lot of people that live here part-time. They're referred to as snowbirders here.
I know a few people from up here that go up there every winter.
Okay, now for them, it's a very unique situation because they're not here in the summer, and that's when that smart meter is, you know, spinning backwards,
yeah.
Okay? And then they come for the winter time. And there's a chance that they're going to produce more electricity with that system on their roof than they're going to use for the 4 or 5 months that they're here. The way it works is each year is calculated. Let's say you produce more kilowatts than you use. Then you do get a check from the utility company for the difference, but it is based on the wholesale cost of kilowatt. So it's not a lot.
Oh, is that right?
It's not anything. Yeah, it's not anything like what you pay per kilowatt when you see your bill.
Yeah.
And then each year it starts over again.
Yeah.
So, okay.
You got to check yearly?
Very few people do.
Mm-hmm.
Living very moderately, and you've done – there are a number of things. That's the other part of this that is really somewhat disturbing, okay, because this was designed just like, you know, try to get things going economically, get these people that had lost their jobs because of the downside to new construction. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons behind why they did what they did, but it wasn't really thought out, and they could have done some other things. Because if somebody does an install, like we're talking about one of the more expensive ones where they're producing electricity, if they would have been required to put based on the square footage of the home, their history, as far as the usage goes of how many kilowatts a year on average they use, like for the last 3 years, they could have made it so it was you put so many panels on, you put a certain number of solar fans in the attic. When you have solar fans in the attic, then you can start doing a barrier And there are a couple other things, even with insulation, if the house isn't insulated correctly, could have been required in order to get that money for the install. And there would have been a lot better usage of the money, and the people who installed the solar, if they had done all those things, if the companies that did it, they would have had a much more efficient system and seen more savings with the money, and the cost would have been very minimal. I mean, to put a couple solar fans in the attic does not cost a lot, especially when you got the guys on the roof already.
Did you end up in Phoenix? Like, Phoenix seems like an ideal location, right, for your business?
I mean, I came here with the idea that I wanted to do solar again. I've been in and out of solar. I haven't done solar all my life. One of the things that I did for 6 years is when Judge Green deregulated AT&T, he basically made it here in the United States that any company that was doing the same amount of business as any other company with the long distance carriers was guaranteed to be able to receive the same cost per minute. When we started, AT&T was charging people, maybe you don't remember this, you might not be, I don't know how old you are there, Duffy, but
Canada too, right? So.
Yeah, okay, but it was $1 a minute.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they were charging.
For long distance?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, oh yeah. And so when we started, what happened is these companies started, and there were a few of them. We were one of the large ones. We actually traded on the stock exchange. And I was the vice president of marketing and sales for that company for the Midwest and West Coast. And basically what we were referred to as a rebiller. So what we did is we went into businesses and we offered them different formats that they could choose from that would allow them to see who's on the phone, who's not, how many calls they're making, what their long distance bills are from that phone, if they're using the phones properly based on the policies of the company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then what we were able to do, because we paid the carrier and then rebilled them for the money, we were able to give these small businesses the same type of pricing like that. Now, Ford would be a bad example because they're basically their own telephone company, as Boeing is. But say like a company like Apple.
Oh, yeah.
So they were getting – so we were taking these people and saying, okay, instead of paying $1 a minute, you can now pay 50 cents a minute. Then it went to 25 cents a minute. Then it went to six-second increment billing. When we were done – and when I mean done, when we all eventually got bought out by one carrier or another for one reason or another, the industry I was in faded into the sunset, so to speak. We were down to six-second increment billings, and the cost per minute was 6 cents.
Wow, big difference.
I've done and I've done a few different things over the years. That's what I'm saying. Solar's just kind of what when I came here, it was such a good opportunity, and I just like it so much. But right now, like I said, the only way I can really get involved in it, and the only way I will get involved in it, is if it's thermal. The only time I'll do a pool application is if somebody already has an electric heater or a propane or a gas heater. They're using their pool, and then they're using the solar to offset that cost that they're already incurring. Because even in this temperature, unless somebody has a cover on their pool, is okay with just swimming in the afternoon and a few other things, heating up a pool with that many gallons of water, the panels are not going to be to where they're going to change what they can do here anyway as far as swimming goes yearly by a whole lot. Maybe 2.5 months possibly of additional swimming, but not at the same temperature as the water would be in the summer either. It usually works about 10 degrees over whatever the temperature is outside if you're doing everything that you're supposed to be doing right. But if you're paying $350, $400 a month to heat a, really big pool, something like that, and you put the solar up, that will offset that cost dramatically because the water is already warm that's going through the system up through the panels. And there's a factor to it. The warmer the water is, the hotter it – or the quicker it becomes warmer, I should say, when it's – in the panels with the sun hitting on them. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I do those, and I kind of stay away from the PV, but I will do it. I have done it, but I try to talk people out of it unless they're doing it with the purchase of a new home. And then it is really a good thing for them, I think, to do.
If it gets worked into their loan.
Right.
Yeah. You also do some writing?
Yeah, that's my passion. I've been writing pretty much since I was like 17.
Yeah, that's about when I started too, yeah.
Yeah. I enjoy that. I've met some really interesting people that way, which is probably maybe the key point of it.
Online?
Oh no. Well, I've met a few people online too as well. Artists from all over the world. There's artists in Spain and a few other places that use some of the titles from some of my poetry to title their works of art with, and a few bands that have asked me to be able to use the a couple of my works to, you know, turn into songs that they wanted to play, and, you know, different things of that nature. But no, I mean, going out and going to, I mean, I've read my poetry in Baltimore, New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, San Diego, Seattle, Vancouver,
Wow.
That way. So when you go out and you read, and you know what, when people ask me, well, what do you do when you're on vacation? I tell them, well, I try to find a place where I can read my poetry, sell a few books, couple CDs, so I can drink for free. And of course, after a couple of drinks, it's really easy to meet people, right? Especially if they're having a couple with you.
I don't know. There's a couple of places here that they do readings, like weekly or whatever, at certain coffee shops or lounges or whatever. But I've never even been to one, actually.
You should go. I enjoy going and just seeing. For me now, because most, not always, but I would say majority of the people go are a younger crowd. And it is. It's inspiring to see what they're doing, the changes in the mindset of youth comparative to when I was growing up. But it's also the creative aspect of it, and seeing, you know, and some of these people are very, very talented. I mean, how many of them take it seriously to where they continue to write? Who knows? But there's certainly a lot of talented people out there, and now that they have gathered up such a following behind, I guess I will refer to it as rap. I know there's other names to it. It's got that side of it all. It's really gotten a lot more attention to something that doesn't cost people a lot of money to be able to participate in.
And there's like slam poetry and stuff like that. Do you ever see that?
Yeah, I have actually seen that. I was in Baltimore. I think it was the Ethiopian restaurant bar. It just absolutely blew my mind, Duff, to see what these kids were, and not always kids, but young men, young women. I mean, able to recite almost like a novel.
Yeah.
Word for word.
Yeah, a big long performance piece. Eh? There's a lot to it.
Exactly. So, yeah, when I go, I have to take it with me because I've written like maybe 11, 14 books. I doubt right now I could recite to you by memory even one work.
11 to 14 books?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
I have three CDs. Now, only a few of those books have been published by publishers. Some of them are chat books, and a few of them are ones that there's two I'm actually working on publishing right now. So that'll give me five published books by publishers. The rest are just what you would call chapbooks. So when I go to a reading, I'll take a few of the books that, you know, were printed, and then I'll take a few of the chapbooks that a friend assisted me in having, and I'll take a few CDs. If somebody wants to, you know, spend $5 or something like that, give them a CD or one of the chapbooks. If they want to spend a little bit more, you know, for one of the published books, and that's cool too.
Does the stuff from your chapbooks end up in the bigger the published ones?
Sometimes,
yeah.
Not always. When you go on the internet, I don't know if you've looked on the internet to see in my work. There's a lot of my work that's on the internet, but it's minimal. There's probably, I don't know, posted on maybe a 40 or 60 different websites, maybe a total of about 80 works.
Mm-hmm.
I probably have about 400 that I've completed and 600 or more that I've been working on for 40 years or longer, still can't figure out what it was I was trying to, but they're not yet. But I'm working on them. And then some other things that I've done, a couple plays that I haven't published or anything like that. I haven't even really done anything with them, but someday.
Do you take part in like any writer circles or any forums online, like poetry forums, where people like critique each other's work and stuff like that?
I have. There was a couple times I've been involved with groups, but not on the internet, live groups. It was a real good group in San Diego. Actually, friends of mine, Katika and her husband, Benjamin, own a Wired Cafe, and we used to do poetry readings there. The people that participated, we would get together and do stuff like that. And then I did it in Seattle, where I'm from, as well at one time. I try to stay away from academics and anything that has any kind of rules to it. Most of my work is free verse, some prose. I probably, in all the works that I have, maybe only have two poems that actually have rhythm. Though one of them is a major work called Times Opera, 19 Parts, and it rhymes.
Oh, yeah?
Sort of.
I play around with rhyming in poems, but I never stick to any strict structure very often either. It seems like
it's hard to.
For sure, yeah. A lot of times it's a compromise.
Exactly, true, very true.
But the guys that can, totally. There's some people that can, they have such a huge vocabulary and so much experience that they can do like, you know, really structured pieces that don't seem like it's any compromise at all. And those are some of the best poems.
I agree totally. Yeah. I look at it. I mean, everybody has their own different way of looking at it. I like the concept that really comes from a poet, a French poet. Don't have a lot of his works because he destroyed a lot of them. I don't know if you've read him, Arthur Rimbaud. But it's the concept is that each consonant and vowel has a color, and that your rhythm, your rhyme, comes from based on where the colors flow through the work from that changing of consonant and vowel versus it being the rhyme of the actual sound
yeah.
Of the vowel or consonant. Yeah. And I'm tone deaf, which even makes it crazier because I've got that vocabulary, but about a third of the words I know, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce them in English or any other language.
So you went like New York, Vancouver. You were just on vacation, or you went there specifically for readings, or?
Well, let's see. On the East Coast, when I went there, let's see. I'm thinking it was year 2000. There's a group there. It's called the International Platform Association. It was started by Daniel Webster. I think their key to fame is that they're the oldest nonprofit organization. I don't know what they're doing now. I was, you get introduced to them and then you can have a membership in it. And I was a member for a period of time when I was in college and I dropped out of it. And then I looked it up because I knew I was going to be going to Washington, D.C. Well, they invited me to read their poetry there and then they were having the Carl Sandburg Award. So from there, I talked to a few different people and they told me some places that I would probably find interesting. And so I talked to a couple other people and they said, well, yeah, you should come to and read here. And that's how that happened. And then there was a really cool place, but they cut it down because it got so big there in San Diego. In fact,
they cut it down because it got big.
They had so many people coming to the poetry readings that, yeah, the local police, the neighborhood stopped them from being able to continue having them anymore.
Wow.
Claire de Lune. And then there's a place there, too, that I used to read called Joe's Bar, which is where Jewel, the
singer?
Folk singer,
yeah.
Yeah, and poet, would go periodically, too, when she was before she, you know, hit the charts.
Oh, yeah? Joe's Bar?
Yeah. Yeah, Joe's Bar. So tell me about you, Duff. What do you do in Alberta?
Right now, I run equipment. I'm building subdivisions in Edmonton, Alberta. I'm from, I was born and raised on a reserve in northern Alberta. I'm actually, I applied for school at the University of Alberta to take anthropology this starting this September, so I'll see if I get in.
That sounds like a really cool gig. Hopefully you will. I've been there. I don't know if you know where Okanagan is. That's where I grew up as a kid. I've spent a lot of time in Canada. In fact, I have three kids that are dual citizens.
Oh, is that right?
Their mother's from Vancouver, BC, yeah.
Oh, nice. Okanagan's nice, eh?
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
It really is.
I was like most people from where I'm from, like, sad to say, but not too many of us finished high school and stuff. Right. And started working pretty young and had my son pretty young and stuff. And, like, one of the easiest or the most available jobs. Like, I live a few hours away from the tar sands, and it's really oil province.
Right.
And forestry.
Yeah.
So was the jobs that were available, and that's still what I'm doing, running heavy equipment and stuff. And when you're young, like 18, 19 or whatever, that's good money if you can go there. You work for 3 weeks straight or more and come out for like 4 days to a week and then do it again.
Right.
Yeah. And 11, 12 hours a day and stuff or whatever. But as like young guys just out of high school, if they take in a year or two between high school and college, it's actually pretty good. Like, they can save up and, you know, get a down payment on a house or whatever they're going to do. But as a career, it's a
tough way to make a living.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
No matter how much, if you're with a company for 8 years, 10 years, and you start to get, you know, you start to get your hourly wage goes up and up and more hours, but you're just, your whole life is work. Your whole life is staying in a camp.
Yeah, that's tough. I know that's not that exact job, but I've done labor like that myself.
I'm First Nations. So in Canada, I'm not sure, like in Alberta anyway, our schooling gets paid for, our tuition and stuff gets paid for. And then
that's cool.
Yeah. And then we'd get like a little living allowance, like not too many people, you can't live off of it, but still, like, it's a huge advantage compared to the regular Canadian citizen, right?
Right.
So to not take advantage of that's crazy. Both my parents went to college and got it paid, or went to university and got their degrees and stuff. And it's just, when you have that advantage, it's hard not to, yeah.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Now, what made you decide to start this website that you have?
Counterculture?
Yeah.
Been writing for a while. Like, I wrote poetry, like you, starting when I was 17 and stuff, whatever. But then I started to write columns for a few different native websites in Canada.
Okay.
The Wind Speaker and a couple other ones I've had articles published in. And So I almost don't write poetry anymore and haven't for a while. Sometimes I'll go back into my old notebooks and kind of work on some stuff. But mostly I'm so interested in world events and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
World events and local events. Like I said, I live so close to the tar sands, and I've even worked up there. I've seen it firsthand and stuff or whatever, and I know that Gateway Pipeline that's supposed to go to the coast of British Columbia and it, like, right where the big salmon run is and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that.
I'm familiar.
Yeah, that goes right through, like, my home is.
Yeah.
So issues like that, like, they're fairly large issues, and they're right in my backyard. So things like that I really took an interest in. And the more I started to look at things like that, I got into, I watched the Zeitgeist movies. I started to see the kind of stuff that Anonymous was doing and all these kind of things. And then I started to realize, like, you can take an active role in all these things. Like, it's not just news stories. It's actually, if it happens in your area or even if it happens somewhere else in the world, especially nowadays with the internet and everything, you can take part somehow, or you can have an opinion.
Yeah, and the more people that are there making their opinion known, hopefully, eventually, there will be enough people that it will force these individuals who put money before responsibility in place, where they're going to have to start making decisions based on some common sense. Totally.
It's so crazy when you think about some pretty simple things, like should be common sense, like you said, like medicine or something like that, where decisions are made based on money. Like, no, we don't want to approve certain medicines or certain drugs that overall are going to lose money for us. You know what I mean? Right. Like that's what the decision is made based on. Will it make us money or lose us money over like show if it'll lose money over the long run or whatever, then that's the basis on approving. Same thing with housing, like they build houses cheaper now. To me it seems like they build them a lot cheaper, a lot less quality, and that's just a money decision, right? Like even though the technology and the know-how and stuff should be improving and the housing should be getting better and more efficient and more like disaster proof and all these things, it's actually getting worse and worse.
It is.
That's just crazy.
There's a lot of things going on. I mean, I was in Seattle for the WTO, and I mean, I could tell you all the different places I've been. I was in Paris when Jimmy Morrison's they announced that he had passed.
Oh yeah.
And I've been to a number of them, and I'm looking to see what happens with this new movement. I'm watching it online, talking to different individuals. And as you said, there's a lot of radical thinkers within the group, but they have an opportunity, and it's a very unique opportunity because it's the first time in this country that more than 52% of the people agreed on anything, and you got almost 80% of the people agreeing that the people in Congress, our elected representatives, all are, you know, living in never-never land. I'm hoping that they come up with a platform, because whether you're talking about Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement or protests against the Vietnam War, there was a specific thing that they were protesting against and a certain thing that they wanted to see happen. And here, I understand the idea of no leaders and keeping things to where it's just each person coming to stand against, you know, the corruption of big business and how that influences the political system and what we refer to as democracy, if we still have democracy or not. I'm not sure, but my theory is if one woman can get 150,000 names on a petition and stir up everything that took place against the banking institutions, if they were to come with a platform of absolute things that they demand to be changed in our Constitution, such as like how long the Supreme Justice actually hold that office, how many Supreme Justices there are, how does it get rotated, term limits, restrictions on the amount of money that a corporation or even an individual can contribute, or how much money a campaign can spend all overall, how much television time should be allocated, even with tax dollars, so that we know that these individuals are on the media in front of us on the television, so that we can see who they are.
I wanted to get back to what you were saying about Occupy Wall Street or the Occupy movement in general, because that's an argument that I hear a lot, and that's pretty much the general. Like some people that haven't really looked into what the people at Occupy Wall Street are saying or whatever, they hear other people and they just echo that sentiment that they don't have an organized platform and all that stuff. Like that is fairly accurate, but some people that's just their way of dismissing it. But I think the fact that it's not a really they're not pointing their fingers at one thing and saying this is the problem or whatever, I think that's a reflection of how widespread the problems that exist are.
Yeah,
like and the fact that it's really an overall systemic problem, you know what I mean, and it affects different people in different areas of their life or whatever. But really the constitutional fixes that people recommend and the like fixing certain laws, or it's past that time in my opinion. I might be more radical than some people because I don't know, maybe because of being First Nations and being two or three generations away from like this huge culture shock and stuff. Like my dad's grandfather who raised him lived a totally different lifestyle, and my dad is like in between two lifestyles, and I'm just, you know, slightly removed from that. But the system that, you know, you can trace back through history, through, you know, imperialism and stuff like that. It just seems short-sighted and it seems unrealistic.
Well, let me kind of throw a couple of thoughts at you about all this, okay? Like Paint Ghost Warrior, that was dedicated to the 1969 occupation of Alcatraz. I mean, you had the Black Panthers, you had the Democratic Society for Change. I mean, you had the Chicago 7 with Abbie Hoffman and Rubin. I mean, you had radical people looking to accomplish a lot of different things, stop different things from occurring. Most of it was focused on ending the war, but there was a lot more to it and regarding social, civil rights, et cetera, et cetera. The problem occurs is this. These people have so much money and so much power and influence that they will survive whatever you can come up with. And if you give them reason enough, they'll take those surveillance cameras that they now have on the streets and put them in your fucking homes and get away with it.
Yeah.
So my theory is you play into them.
But I think,
and then you give them basically permission, and since they have control of so much of the infrastructure, our society. Even during the Great Depression, there were very few of the 1% that jumped off the Empire State Building or folded. Most of them came out with more money than they walked, than they had when it started.
Oh, for sure. Because disaster or hard times, it creates a necessity, and they capitalize on it. That's what they do.
Absolutely. Yeah. You got it exactly. So here's how you hurt them. You want to hurt them? You take it away from them. You take their power away from them. And the way that you take the power away from them, we have a constitution today that was designed around some guys that were really intelligent, came up with some really psychedelic ideas, and put a really unique concept in writing and, you know, fought a war against an opponent that was, you know, across the ocean, got some other players who hated them involved in it and got their independence and set up this constitution with the articles and sections of it and the rules of how it could be changed. What's happened over the years is at different times changes have taken place, some good, some indifferent, some bad, but they've in overall they've changed because the people who vote at a congressional level, whether it's the Senate or Congress, with a president approval without a veto, and in some cases with enough votes to even override a veto, have made those changes. And those changes were made intentionally by the 1% so that the Constitution works for them. And even now that, and when it was put in place, like your Environmental Protection Agency, there are more companies that are defying the law and still operating, pay attorneys more money than they might be earning based on the principle that they will not allow somebody to dictate to them what they can do or can't do, regardless of how harmful it is to the nature, to the people who live in their community, whether it's, you know, the pollution of the water or the product that they're making in itself is destructive. So the way that you get to them is to take it away. Say you don't get this anymore. You don't control the United States military anymore. You don't get to have whoever you want in office. And when you do find somebody, you are able to financially persuade everybody that they're the person that they should vote for. They're going to be limited to how long they can be there. So how much do you really want to invest in them? Because they're only going to be there so long. And also the fact that you take away from those people who serve in office the viability for a period of time since they're getting a pension anyway, a really good pension with medical and dental. You take away the rights for them to go to work for these people, get book deals, circuit deals for a period of time after being in office, and all of a sudden you're going to have a more academic and people who actually have really the right to make the decisions for populace because they have the education and the understanding, the know-how to rebuild what is falling apart. And don't get me wrong, I understand the Third Industrial Revolution due to what occurred in the early parts of World War II, even though we could say it was the actual industrialists of the world who supported the starting of World War II. We still have to go to the fact that at some point it got out of hand, and if we didn't stop the Axis, we would have been living in a fascist world. So there's a good point to a certain aspect of the Third Industrial Revolution. However, the building of the dams for electricity, nuclear power plants, and other things that even at that time, a third of that could have came, if not 60% of it, from the wind and solar even then, and it wasn't implied. It was only because of money, not because of the lack of technology. So,
oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, the guys that were in charge then, they weren't into solar and stuff. They were the oil tycoons and all those guys.
Cement and gravel.
Yeah,
cement, gravel. So what I'm trying to say, I understand where you're coming from, and hey, I mean, God bless you for, you know, wanting to take all that on. The problem that I see with this, having watched it year after year, you know, time after time, it goes so far, you get something, and then everything goes away. I'd like to see changes made that change the dynamics of how things are done forever. And the only way you can do that is change the rules by which these people have to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires changing the laws.
Mm-hmm. I think in order to do that, though, it's going to have to come to a point where the quote-unquote 99% are going to have to, like, the Occupy movement is going to have to get a lot bigger to where it's an actual threat to the way things operate. Otherwise, why would they? You're talking about changing the laws or changing the Constitution or at least going back to following the Constitution. That's going to take changes.
Well, the Constitution,
it's going to take changes from the people that it's benefiting to not change it. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm not talking about changing everything, but let's just look at, you have 12 supreme justices.
Yeah.
That worked for when there was 13 colonies, maybe 20 states. That's not appropriate in the world that we live in today. And the fact that these people stay in office until they die, well, when that constitution was written and that part of it was figured out, the lifespan was usually, you know, at the max 40, 45 years old. Now they're living to be 85 and 90 and walking in and making decisions on steroids.
Yeah. No, but you know? I mean that type of change, exactly. Like that type of change, that change has to come from the government.
Well, that's how you do it. See, my thought is you have to do exactly what the forefathers did. You have to write a new constitution, and then you put it in front of them with 500 million names. I don't even care who signs it and from what country, what nationality,
yeah,
or what religion they believe in. And you say, this is what you have to do tomorrow. And if you don't, then I would agree with you. You just need to take, like Peter, Paul, and Mary said, you're just going to have to tear the building down and start all over. But you got to at least take the energy and all the intellect and understanding of what's wrong and try to find a way that you can put something in place that gives the people who have the know-how, the technology, the education, and the people who want to do the work who are out of jobs an opportunity to have a decent life without all the turmoil that occurs when you have things going on like what's happening like in Syria. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, a lot of people don't remember Kent State. Let me tell you something. If you decide that you're going to change this without doing it within the structure of what the law allows you to do, you just give them the justification to do what they're going to do. And unfortunately, I don't care how many millions of people you have, if you don't demand something to be done, they will just kind of let you go through the motions, throw you a bone, thank you very much, and you'll go and maybe throw, you know, a couple changes in the law there that makes everybody think, okay, everything's going to be different. I mean, in 1972, they made a law in California that no automobile company would sell cars that were, unless they were permitted to, based on the job necessity of the need, that were not going to produce 26 miles to a gallon. They made the law, but it was never enforced.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, they can do. You can say do whatever you want. The fact is nothing is going to change unless you take their power away. And the way you take their power away is change the Constitution, make it so that the people who are making the decisions for us are the people that deserve that job, not the ones who've been given that job because they're willing to follow orders from the 1% and do exactly what the fuck they're told by them, so that when they're done with screwing us, they can go get not only their pension that we pay for, but get the big bucks for going to work for a think tank, doing the
being
speech
consultants
circuit
and stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah, the whole nine yards. Yeah. Sure, it's a yeah. I mean, basically, it's just like Ralph Nader, the selling of America. I mean, it's already sold, and then the businesses that are out there that have some significance as far as the revamping infrastructure, that have the capability, if they're not on these people, if they're not on these guys' payroll, if they're not following their lead, so to speak, they don't get the contracts.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, there's a smaller and smaller group of companies that get the contracts. Whether exactly. whether it's rebuilding the nations that we bomb, or whether it's stuff over here, it's a smaller and smaller group. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot to it, but I really think, and you should go to the website and sign on to OccupyTogether.com.
Yeah, yeah.
If you haven't already, okay. And there's some interesting viewpoints there as well as on the different occupied Facebooks across the United States and even throughout the world. There's a lot of people out there coming up with a lot of ideas. If they get to a point where they can put these ideas into a format that says, okay, here's the changes that maybe not everybody agrees with, but you know what? We can look at and say, if we're representing 99% of the people, 80% of them are going to look at this and go, if this was done the way that it's outlined to be done, it would change the world, and whatever it is it means to me and my children, I can honestly feel that it's going to be better than if it stays the way it is now, and you put it in front of those fuckers and say either you do this or you're out, then you'll have not only the people, the signatures on the petition to prove that you have the votes or a percentage of that 99% who has agreed with that, mm-hmm. that's the change that they want. And if they don't do it, then you'll have an excuse for a rebellion that will possibly take their buildings down.
Yeah, because I think I hear these people, like there's this new National Defense Authority Act or whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
that Obama just approved or whatever, and it's like a continuation of the Patriot Act. I hear like a lot of, like, I'm not from the States, so I don't know how bad it really is, but I hear a lot of people like they're going to move to other countries or, you know, stocking up on food or whatever. Like they're worried now, like what they talk about on the internet or whatever, getting labeled as a terrorist, getting taken from their home and then detained indefinitely. Like that's some of the language in that act, right?
And hints again, and I think, you know, I mean, it's hard to say this because so many people gave their lives. I mean, it's not like the civil rights movement in this country just happened. I mean, people died, people gave up their lives, people were assassinated. But the movement remained nonviolent. And what they were looking for was change. And it's taken a long time to see even the beginning of the results, what all that went for. But you do see it happening. But still, it's somewhat restricted to a certain degree. But there's more opportunity for everybody. Still, the positions overall that are in corporate boardrooms, et cetera, those jobs are minimal. But you do see more, and it's cool. But it's still very minimal to compare, I think, to what could have occurred had they demanded certain additional changes besides
the laws that they did get put in place, but what they did accomplish is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time that they started, people of certain color couldn't even ride a bus in many states. So, I mean, and that movement accomplished what it did because of the fact that it was nonviolent and it worked within the laws of what the government allows. Now, what people are getting afraid of is that they're changing those laws, taking your civil rights to protest. And
yeah, it seems like some of these new laws and stuff are aimed at protesters.
Mm-hmm. And I understand why they're frightened of it, because without civil dissent, there is only one other possibility for the future, and that is a revolt.
I don't promote violence.
I'm saying I understand what you're saying, but I'm talking about the other side of the coin is a more rigid government that is not maybe for the people, by the people. Democracy could go another direction. I mean, that we had a president not that long ago, Nixon, who ended up, by the way, resigning. I'm sure you're probably familiar with all the story. But at one point in time, he was trying to get a bill passed in the administration that would allow him to run for a third term, too.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Right? So what I'm trying to say is you push, and when you push, then that just gives them the excuse to change things, which they have the ability to do, unfortunately, too easily. That's why you have to change the Constitution itself and the laws that govern big business, govern how our national resources are used, govern how decisions are made, whether a pipeline should or shouldn't be, who makes that decision implemented, where oil can be dug, how many cars that are produced need to be hybrid electric comparative to fossil fuel or natural gas. And I mean, really lay it down to where it's a science, to where we know exactly what we're doing as far as the pollution with carbon dioxide into our ozone, so that we're starting to take it back from this point where it's reached to where there already are holes in the ozone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are coming at a point in time, 2012, which is really exciting because everybody talks about
it. In Australia, you can't go bearskin. You're not supposed to go bearskin in Australia.
Yeah. Well, they talk about the 2012 calendar of the Mayans, for instance. Well, there's numerous calendars. There's one that goes to the year 4042, I believe it is. What happens in 2012 is very unique because you have the Earth and then the Sun and the center of the Milky Way in direct alignment, which occurs about every 65,000 years. Now, geologists have known this and scientists have known this. It's funny how they don't share every aspect of what truly is going on because, as Frank Herbert said in Dune, fear is the mindset. It is easier to control any group, whether it's a large or small group, out of fear.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so that said, at the same time that this is happening, we are also going to hit the peak of the 13-year cycle where our sun produces the most and largest severe solar
flares
simultaneously. And that's why we're seeing, I mean, it's not because the fourth seal, of Revelations has been open. This is nature, and it's predictable.
Yeah, yet, to a certain degree, yeah.
Yet there are all these different fractions, whether you want to look at it religiously or politically or whatever, who try to take these things that are going on and then influence people to believe something else, totally else, is happening so that they can take advantage of those people's fear.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's donations in the basket, or donations to their campaign, or they're buying their products, because they figure that, the end of the world's coming or whatever.
There's those people that they get people to take care of their pets in the afterlife or something. They pay for that service. There were some people that did that. Mm-hmm. When they thought that last big prediction of, I don't know what religion it was, but they like, I think it was sometime this year, and they predicted the world was going to end.
Right, I remember this.
Yeah, so some people started a website and saying, we'll take care of your pets until they get to the afterlife, or we'll take care of them in the afterlife, one of the two anyway, but they actually made quite a bit of money too.
I know, capitalism at its finest.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to die whether you do or not, though. Yeah. Don't take a chance. That pet of yours is going to need a place, and we're here to take care of him. I love it.
That's awesome.
It is. It's crazy. Well, I was just going to put on the website the other day about how the Grand Canyon made an announcement 3 days ago, the national park here, that they were going to prohibit the sale of plastic bottles and containers, et cetera, at the park because of the amount of pollution that is created and such. And then today, before I even got a chance to put it on the website, I find that Coca-Cola got involved and put a stop to the whole
That's idea. Crazy.
Huh?
That's crazy. I mean, did you see that that plastic island in the ocean?
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see that?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
It's on ViceTV.com or Vice TV. I don't know. If you search Vice TV,
yeah,
they do documentaries on like some of the craziest places in the world and stuff. But yeah, they did one on that, and they went out on a boat and went to that. It's so messed up, man.
Well, I saw one yesterday that was absolutely one of the people I work with showed me. They had the whole house, the fence, the garden. It was in France. We were debating on whether it was on the southeastern Nice side or if it was south of Bordeaux, but the whole house, fencing, yard, every part of it was made out of oranges and lemons.
Oh yeah,
full structure. So yeah, people are out there doing some wild and crazy things.
Oh yeah, I always look into I'm on a few forums, like sustainability forums and stuff like that, and see like how far some people have gone with you know, those Earthship houses and stuff. You must, in Arizona, they have those, right?
Yeah.
The Earthships, yeah. And making houses out of those storage containers and stuff like that. And yeah,
it's really big in Texas right now.
Oh, yeah?
Because they're so inexpensive.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
And a lot of people are at that point. I mean, it's a crazy mixed up world. There's no doubt about it. However, I have three rules. I mean, as long as you believe in a loving God, I really don't care what your religion or what language you speak to God in or call him.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, and two is there's a word I found. I'm not a Bible thumper by any means, though I love theology, and which goes right along with, you know, anthropology and geology, yeah, et cetera. But there's this one word in the Bible, and you only find it in the Bible. It's been erased entirely from every dictionary, encyclopedia, and any other work. I have not been able to find it. And basically, it's supposedly a word spoken by God that gives man his directive of what he considers him to be responsible for in inheriting the earth and the planet and all that came with it that the Creator gave us. And that was and the word refers to the responsibility of being the guardian of the planet, that our responsibility is to take care of everything. So, you know, looking at Freud and Hume and going, hey man, can you come up with some idea better than anything else that's been thrown out there to psychoanalyze, okay, why we do things the way that we do? I start looking and thinking and doing a little reading and coming up, trying to figure it all out. And this goes back to that whole concept of fear. But psychologically, I think what has happened is that we all, as much as we appreciate whatever it is that we consider to be the higher power, that beauty of nature, or the unit, when we allow the universe to take over things for us and things all of a sudden start turning out right, or We put prayer out together and we see change made by, you know, our conscious thought collectively doing something that could be done no other way, whatever it is. That, right?
Yeah, there's even scientists are starting to, a lot of scientists have the same view from a different angle, like that everything's made up of energy and energy affects other energy and so on.
Right.
And it's pretty much the same thing, right?
So you put this together psychologically. So why, if it's so easy to be the guardian and take care of things, do we go about and have from the beginning done exactly the opposite of what God put us here for, based in this under this scenario, and destroy everything around us one way or another, slowly, gradually, or sometimes, you know, with one big bomb. And you know what? I can't help but think that it is the fact that because we are here, and the fact that we have to deal with the reality that we are going to die, that we are so pissed off about it subconsciously, that in being that upset and angry about it, we have decided subconsciously to destroy that which gave us what we have because of that one factor, that we don't have it forever.
So we're not taking care of it as we were supposed to?
No, we ain't. But it's not that we ain't, that we know. It's the reason why, that the psychological part
of
it.
Yeah, it totally doesn't make sense.
I'm discussing.
Yeah, because like I've heard, do you know who Joe Rogan is?
I don't think so.
He's the host of Fear Factor. He does he's a stand-up comedian and stuff. Anyway,
my son watches that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he has one of the biggest podcasts there. He's one of the top podcasters. But yeah. He described it as man is like cancer on Earth.
Uh-huh.
Like they just spread and destroy and whatever. And yeah. and like you said, it seems counterintuitive. Like why would we destroy the place where we live, especially when we have the smarts and the capabilities to not do that?
Because we're pissed off.
So when was it, Jim Morrison? You were in France, you said?
Oh, yeah.
And that's where he lived, right? That's where he passed away?
Yeah, he passed away in France.
So when was that? What year was it?
What was it, 1970, 71, something like that?
So how old were you when Woodstock happened?
What, 19?
Were you
20?
There?
No, I wasn't in Woodstock, but I did a lot of the ones on the West Coast. That was East Coast.
Yeah.
I was a West Coast guy.
Oh, yeah. You did. So you saw the Grateful Dead and all them?
Oh, yeah. I worked backstage for a while at the Roundhouse in London, and actually did a few fun things over the years. Got to see, was there when Stevie Woodwind and Traffic rented out a castle to record High Heel Boys. Saw Pink Floyd not only in Amsterdam, which was one of the most coolest things I'd ever experienced, but also one time at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, where they spent a whole night just playing blues. And I mean, you didn't even have to light your pipe. There was enough smoke in the air that all you had to do was breathe, and you were floating on a, you know, on the astral plane, at least, if not further in space. But yeah, beautiful day. I mean, different bands. I always liked going to the festivals of music. It was what I did. I mean, I spent a lot of time hitchhiking around the United States, Europe, and stuff. I was probably 26 before I decided I needed to actually
live somewhere,
do something.
Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with that. Did you see Bob Dylan?
I have.
Yeah?
Yeah. A few of those people, yeah. One of my favorite artists is actually a Canadian, Leonard Cohen.
Oh, yeah, Leonard Cohen, yeah.
Yeah, in fact,
saw
him.
He's a poet, slash songwriter.
Poet, musician,
yeah.
Author,
yeah.
Very talented individual.
Yeah,
probably.
He's done a theme song of The Sopranos for people that's where a lot of people might know him from.
Well, they do a lot of his songs different times. They did Hallelujah, I think it was at the Academy Awards this time around, or something like of that nature. But anyway, yeah, he's
an awesome songwriter, man. Yeah,
he really is. And Bob Dylan, of course, is too.
Oh, Neil Young. Did you ever see
Willie Nelson? Neil Young, seen them? Yep.
Right on. Wow, that's another reason that I started the website. Like, rather than it being a Activism Today website.
Right.
I called it counterculture, and counterculture is a term that isn't really used much these days. It's more back then, right? The anti-Vietnam movement and all that stuff. Because that time period really appeals to me, and that appeal has never died, you know what I mean? For young people. Like,
oh, yeah. Allison's Restaurant.
Yeah.
Guthrie. In fact, I'm doing two major works right now because I'm actually visiting some friends that live outside of Las Vegas. I'm doing an ode to rock and roll and Symphony of Lovers, the piece by Picasso that sits in, at Wim's Palace. But I actually use the counterculture theme in the Ode to Rock and Roll as the ideology that for 50 years just keeps rocking on. So
I don't know. I've talked to a few people. I think the first or second podcast that I did, I talked to a guy from New York who was at Woodstock when he was 17.
Uh-huh. Right.
And a lot of people would think like, okay, we're looking back at the performances and stuff, and we're thinking like hippies, we could lay around and take acid and smoke weed and just be peaceful and whatever. But we're kind of romanticizing the period because there was a lot of struggle and people got their heads busted by the cops and whatever and stuff. But when
overall, the music
and the the togetherness of the people that were involved in the counterculture, still people do say like it's everything that it's, you know, that you hear about it and stuff.
Yep. Being from Seattle, like I'll never forget Rainier Park, which I don't think is there anymore. It used to be where the baseball team played before they had a professional team there. Jimi Hendrix playing Star Spangled Banner with his teeth on his electric guitar.
Oh, yeah.
that was out there.
That was before Woodstock, eh?
Yeah. He passed 71
or Bush. Something?
Yeah, I was there hanging out with some people that worked for Release at that time. I was staying in a house just a couple houses down from where he was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy times. A lot of bad shit happened, man.
Yeah, everybody got into, like, the drug scene kind of went different directions. Some people got into some bad shit.
Well, and sometimes you have to wonder how that bad shit got there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm definitely a conspiracy theorist, okay? and knowing, and if you've read Ken Kesey's works or his history and all the different things that have been done over the years, there's no doubt in my mind that an individual can be programmed if the need is felt to be there to do things that they would not do otherwise. And I think there are numerous incidences throughout history where people have been, let's just say, bushwhacked, okay? And it's been made to look like one thing happened and possibly something altogether happened differently.
Like Janis Joplin and people like that? Those kind of people? Just because of how influential they were?
John Lennon?
John Lennon is more...
Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. John Lennon he was more outspoken. Like, Hendrix and him were just kind of, iconic in the movement.
Well, John Lennon took it to another level. There's no doubt about that, but... You know,
he was pretty much the biggest figurehead that the hippies had on their side. Like, he was on major news stations talking about peace. He was on The Tonight Show and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he was...
But still the others were there, and there's a lot to their story that, you know, not only kept the movement going on, but the music and verse that inspired it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been a wild time. So that's all the time me and Joe had. I'll probably have him on the show again since he's involved with the site. I want to say thanks to everybody that's been listening to the show so far. I really appreciate it. I'm going to keep it going. And here's the smallest to take us out. Thanks.
From the deepest tricked and tethered to its bosom like a snare. A stitch was torn and a bell was broken, self-fulfilling, spread and spilled there for the deepest heart, could I hear?